All right, the next case is 20-1640, 20-1644, DNC LLC versus Philadelphia Indemnity Insurance Company. Here's another insurance case. Here we go again. All right, Mr. Brown, you're up.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is David Brown. I'm with Goldberg Sagala Firm in Greensboro, North Carolina. I have the privilege of representing Philadelphia Indemnity Insurance Company in this case. Judge Diaz, I appreciate the court's comments about not being experts after sitting here for the last argument and now knowing what you've read in this one coming in. We're going to be experts on the collapse coverage and commercial property policies here soon enough, so I appreciate that very much. Of course, this is indeed a case that involves several issues. Fundamentally, my client, Philadelphia, appeals a determination there was coverage under a collapse endorsement and a commercial property policy for a loss that occurred in Ely, North Carolina. And then we also appeal the determination that there was a willful violation of the North Carolina Unfairness Such a Trade Practices Statute, such that attorney's fees were awarded to the plaintiff. And then the plaintiff cross appeals the district court's determination that only nominal damages would be awarded as a result of the violation of that statute. So this loss occurred to a commercial building in North Carolina. It was a student apartment building, as the court is well aware, a 14-year-old building built in 2004, and the loss date was reported as 2018. I think the record is clear and undisputed that there were significant construction problems here. There was water that was allowed to intrude into the cavity of the breezeway, the walkway, if you will, underneath the second floor of the student housing, the apartment building. It's undisputed that the laundry dryers from the washer and dryer room were allowed to vent into that crawl space. And over time, there have been significant deterioration, significant wood rot, and significant problems created as a result thereof, necessitating significant repairs that needed to be made. On the morning of January 14, 2018, there was a report that a number of students from the university had been gathered on the second floor on that breezeway. Kind of unclear in the record, candidly, how many there were, but clearly there were a number, 15 on the low end, as many as 100 students in the apartment building at some point that night on the high end. And then thereafter, there was noticed a deflection, sagging, a cracking, again, depending upon where you look in the record, anywhere from an inch to a foot. But the pictures, I think, make pretty clear in the joint appendix that it was a deflection of a couple of inches or so in that walkway. The claim was reported to Philadelphia. It immediately adjusted the claim, sent out an investigator who indicated that there was that in his initial opinion, the loss resulted from this long-term deterioration. Immediately, an engineer was hired. The engineer retained by Philadelphia came out, offered an opinion and a report that the loss was not caused by any sort of abrupt event that occurred, but rather was the result of long-term deterioration. And fast forward to discovery in this case, the plaintiff's engineer really didn't dispute that. So I think we've got a situation where there is an event that happened of some sort, some amount on that early morning hours of January 14, 2018. You've also got a situation where the repairs were also needed, undoubtedly because of long-term problems that had gone on due to defective construction.
Correct me if I'm wrong, I don't recall there being any evidence that the sagging or cracking or collapsing or whatever we're comfortable calling it, that was occurring gradually over time. There was evidence that the structural integrity was being undermined, but that, you know, in a moment during this student party, the collapse, for lack of a better word, happened, that there was something abrupt, even if the structural integrity of the supports had been slowly deteriorating. I don't recall there being any evidence that there wasn't this sort of abrupt moment when things changed.
Well, the engineer, Mr. Moore from Philadelphia, whose report is in the appendix, he testified that it was not an abrupt event, but rather was a long-term event. But I will agree with Your Honor that the first notice of any sort of crack in that area was at the student party that night. I think one of the questions becomes, what really caused the need for the repairs? Was it the long-term event, or was it that sudden event? But I acknowledge the court's point.
That do you contest that? Oh, sorry. So the collapse, I'm a little perplexed by this. The additional coverage provision says it only applies to abrupt collapse, which it defines as abrupt falling down or caving in. But the exclusion above that refers to collapse, not just abrupt collapse, which I guess we should take to mean falling down or caving in that may or may not be abrupt. And I was looking in your brief to see where or if you dispute that this was a falling down or a caving in. Is that something that you know, for purposes of the exclusion and the exception to the exclusion, do you contest that this was a falling down or caving in, that this was a collapse, for whatever that means, under the exception to the exclusion?
We do dispute that. We do dispute that there was a falling down or a caving in. And if I may, and I appreciate the court coming right to the heart of it. So the district court found that there were three exclusions before we get to the collapse endorsement that would bar coverage under the policy: the decay or deterioration exclusion, the faulty workmanship exclusion, and the long-term water exclusion. That's at Appendix 658, kind of footnote 5 on the district court's initial order. That has not been challenged, not disputed, not appealed. So any one of those exclusions standing alone would be sufficient to bar coverage for this claim. So the way to the coverage exists.
You say that's not appealed, but the district court didn't find that those barred coverage because they don't have anti-concurrent cause language, as we talked about in the previous case, right? The district court said that there is coverage. The only one that does, the defective construction, the defective construction goes on to say, even if there's a covered cause, it would be covered. So what do you mean it wasn't appealed?
Well, I guess the point is that the only route to coverage here is through the collapse endorsement. In other words, if there was not, we don't contend the collapse exclusion applies. The question, I think, for the court is whether the collapse endorsement that affords coverage that otherwise would not exist under the policy applies or not. And I think
didn't the district court say that they both applied? Am I misremembering that?
The district court did indeed find that coverage was created via the collapse exclusion. You are correct in remembering that. And we fundamentally contend that coverage cannot be created via an exclusion, that coverage is created through insuring grants and then paired back through exclusions, and then can be reinstated through an exception to exclusion, but that fundamentally the route to coverage is through a grant of coverage.
Brown, I'm a little further down the road than you are. Let's assume the judge was right. He's right about the unfair trade practice. Why shouldn't that be vacated and the damages that are equal to the contract damage be part of the calculation, so that let's just assume it was $300,000, then you go to the unfair trade practice, which he found. Why shouldn't that have been trebled? Which would also take care of the attorney's fees, because it seems to me this is just like some. I understand he can't recover on both, and so it's just a classic election of remedies. So. Didn't the judge err in just awarding a $1 nominal damage in the unfair trade practice?
No, not at all, Your Honor, because the North Carolina Supreme Court answered this very question in the Gray case. The Gray versus joint underwriting case from 2000 that's discussed at length. That very issue was before the Supreme Court, and the Chief Justice Fry's opinion in that case consider the very argument that's been made by BENC here and that the court just outlined. That is, what damages get trebled And what the Supreme Court held is that the legislature intended for the phrase "trouble the amount fixed by the verdict" to mean that damages proximately caused by a violation shall be trebled, not that damages on every claim that happens to arise in a case involving a Chapter 75 violation shall be trebled. The court has stated that in order to recover treble damages, plaintiff must show what injury he incurred as a proximate result of the violation. So, in other words, in order to recover treble damages, a successful litigant has to not only prove all of the elements of the claim, but then prove what damages were proximately caused by that violation. So now that brings us to and begs the question of what was the violation found here? Because as you know, there was a bad faith claim where summary judgment was granted for Philadelphia and not appealed. There were allegations that
Mr. Brown, can I ask you a question about, sorry, this is Judge Diaz, about that. So, I mean, subsequent to Gray, there have been a number of Court of Appeals opinions that have talked about UDTPA claims in the context of what, for lack of a better term, I'll describe as an aggravated breach of contract, where there is a breach of contract, but then there are attendant circumstances that serve to aggravate that breach. And the courts of appeals have held, notwithstanding Gray, in some instances citing to Gray, that in those instances, because the attendant aggravating circumstances are part and parcel of the breach of contract, that those in fact can form the basis for a trebling of damages. Isn't that what we have here?
Respectfully, no, it's not, Your Honor. I think what the cases have held is that if the unfair act caused the claim to be denied, so if Philadelphia engaged in some sort of unfair act that was found either as a matter of law or submitted to the jury and found by a fact finder, that it did something unfair, deceptive, that caused it to deny the claim, then potentially the contract damages could be trebled. But here, the district court found, correctly so, that there was an honest disagreement as to whether there was coverage or not under the collapse endorsement, and consequently granted summary judgment for Philadelphia on the bad faith claim and on three of the four unfair trade practice alleged violations.
You don't have to have bad faith in order to recover under an unfair trade practices case, do you?
You do not, and you have to find willfulness in order to afford attorney's fees, and so that's one of our contentions, is that there's not the requisite willfulness here to award fees. But the court's right, you don't have to have bad faith to have a violation Chapter 75, but what you do have to have is you do have to show what damages were caused by that violation. And to Judge Diaz's point, cases that have found that the contract damages get trebled are necessarily, have been cases where there was something unfair or deceptive in the denial of the claim itself. And here, the violation that was found, bearing in mind the court found in favor of DNC on one of the four alleged violations, violation that was found was a failure to properly explain the position in a denial letter. The violation was not the denial of the claim. The violation was that the denial letter itself was somehow viewed to be confusing, and that the insured had to then, you know, figure out what was meant by that letter, which eventually was done thereafter. But the point is, Judge Diaz, the damages, I think the courts have been been extremely consistent, both in state court and in the federal courts applying North Carolina law, that contract damages do not get trebled unless there was something unfair or deceptive in the very denial of the claim. Otherwise, what an insured has to prove is the damages that were proximately caused by the unfair act. So I think Judge Eagles was right on the mark in tying the need to the question of whether damages could be trebled to a finding of what was unfair. And what was found to be unfair was the denial letter. Nothing more, nothing less, but the denial letter itself, not the fact of the denial, but the fact the argument was that the denial letter was somehow confusing. And as a consequence, that's what was found.
Not just confusing, but deceptive, right? Unfair.
Well, I guess I'll just abide by what the district court said, which is that it was violation of subsection N of 58, 63, 15, 11. But I guess the point here that I want to say is that if you look at the Gray case, it was a hurricane claim. A hurricane was not an unfair trade practice. How the insurance company handled the hurricane claim in certain respects was found to be an unfair trade practice. In that case, the contract damages did not get troubled. Here, if there was a collapse, which we dispute, the collapse was not an unfair trade practice. So whatever damages were caused by that don't get troubled. Rather, there has to be some showing of damages that were proximately caused by the unfair act was found in order to show, to trouble those damages. And I see I'm out of time for now.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. Mr. McDougall.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Thank you, David Brown. Appreciate it. The Mr. Brown made two statements. Courts found treble damages if the wrong conduct is in the denial itself. Here, the wrong conduct was in the denial itself. A letter denying coverage with 9 different misrepresentations, citing the actual wrong provisions that were amended, citing provisions that left out. It only cited the exclusions for the collapse, but not the coverage provisions for the collapse. It also said things like flood may have occurred. Well, there was no flood at Elon. He admitted that. He said boilers may have caused it. There are no boilers at this facility. He admitted that. He went on and on and on, and there were 9 different things. He said, no, that had nothing to do with it. And the best, his boss looked at flood and said, what was he talking about? If you look at it carefully in the letter, he cites the wrong collapse provision that was amended by endorsement, and the entire collapse provision was completely gutted and amended. This Mr. Gertling from Colorado, for some reason, sent that. What is, if you look at it real carefully, though, he then cites the exclusions in the new amended collapse provision that was provided.
I have a question about that, counsel. Judge Rushing, the provision of the N provision that you prevailed under requires a reasonable explanation of the basis for the denial. And it, you have to, in the explanation, you have to cite the policy provisions and the facts. What about the letter was not an explanation of the basis for the insurer's denial? I understand they had extraneous provisions they didn't need to include in the end, but they explained the facts and they cited the collapse provision under which they think coverage should be denied. Now, even if they're wrong about that, that was the basis for their denial. How is this a violation of Section N?
As the judge pointed out, and as I point out, not once did they talk about collision and, collapse applying to anything in the policy. What they did is they took the exclusions and they even put number 1. So the exclusion starts in a section with a number 3. So if you see a 3, you know there's a 1 and 2 that precede it. So it says B3 is what he cited, and those are exclusions. 1 and 2 are coverage provisions. So if you see,
yeah, totally accepting. You're right that the letter didn't quote the entire insurance agreement, and there may have even been misrepresentations. Right, there was a provision that's not even in this policy about fungus or something, right? But you didn't prevail under the misrepresentation provision of North Carolina law. The court found you didn't win under that. And there is a separate provision for misrepresentations where you rely on it or something, and there's no evidence of that. The only thing in front of us on appeal is whether there's an explanation for the basis of denial in this letter. And it looks like there
wasn't. So you have the Rule 58 and the questions. The letter is unbelievable. If you look at it, it doesn't tie any provision of the policy with any of the facts. The judge said that over and over. She said it was a convoluted mess.
And well, it says long-term water intrusion and deteriorated wood framing. the result of an improper installation of dryer vents and failure to install water management systems. And then it cites all the provisions of the policy, I think, that have anything to do with water, because it thinks that this was caused by a water management problem. And it cites parts about deterioration and fungus and things like that.
I apologize for interrupting.
Yeah, but it's hard to hear you when you talk over me.
They have to tie the policy language, though, into the facts, and they never did that. They just cited.
Why do they have to? But they do both of those. Well, you're saying they need to cite the provision after the sentence where they explain why you're denied, and that's why it violates Section N?
If you read it closely, it just says the following exclusions appear in the policy. It doesn't say how flood is involved. It doesn't say how boilers are involved. They're just sending it out to basically.
So you're saying that's not a reasonable explanation for the basis of the denial.
Absolutely.
If they explain why they denied it and they cite the policy provisions, but they don't go on to, for each provision they cite, they don't give an additional explanation of, you know, the reason why we're citing flood to you is X, that North Carolina requires that level of explanation, is what you're saying.
Some level of explanation. There was none. There was nothing.
What's your best case for the level of explanation North Carolina requires? I haven't found any. But I could use some help. I really could use some help from North Carolina on this. I
found a middle district court that had no, just absolutely just said, we're denying the claim, and they said that's a violation.
Right.
Similar to this, it says we're denying the claim on flood. It's, you know, the intent, obviously, and the judge said this. What else would be the intent of putting in boilers when there's no boilers on the site? Flood when there wasn't a flood in Elon in years, if ever. And he just says, I put it in because I wanted to.
Well, I'm not sure that takes away the explanation in the letter. The question is, was there an explanation? Even if you have all these extraneous things, they might be misrepresentations, but you lost on that and you didn't appeal it. But I don't want to take up all your time on this because you'd need to argue about why coverage.
Judge said misrepresentation takes reliance. Our provision does not take reliance. So she ruled in our favor. We don't have to show reliance. Many courts have already said that. And you know, what's the catch 22 here is, okay, you send out a letter like that and the policyholder looks at it and says, I have been deceived. I'm not going to go anywhere. Okay, I believe the insurance company. What happens? They go home. They lose $450,000 because they.
And if you've been deceived, there's a provision for that. But this is just about whether they gave an explanation, even if the explanation was wrong. But it's an explanation they believed and they gave it.
And it's one of the regulatory. I mean, it's actually a statute that you have to do this. And the effect of it is, one, that person's going to believe it and not understand it. I mean, this thing is unbelievable. It only has 3 pages of policy language, and then it has constant changes over and over and over, 100 and I think 50 pages. And the normal person, I mean, I've been doing this for years. I couldn't understand it. And for him then to get a letter with all this stuff, he's going to say, I don't understand it. But what's important, 2 weeks before that, he received a letter from a vice president, home office, Grimoire, Philadelphia, saying, you have coverage and we will be paying your claim. No retraction, no reservation of rights. He thinks that my claim's going to be paid. They have yet today say that doesn't count. So we've got a letter saying we're going to be paid. Then they send a letter that makes no sense saying you're not going to get paid. And we're going to cite all.
Mr. McDougal, can I ask a question about the Supreme Court's decision in Gray, because your colleague mentioned that case is dispositive on this issue of trebling damages. And as I understand, his argument is it's that because his client was entitled at least to contest the issue of liability on coverage, that any damages that flowed from the manner in which they contested the coverage, and you've outlined that in the letter, all the things that they said in the letter that I think I would agree with you don't seem to make sense, but that wasn't the proximate cause of your client's damage. It was the denial of the coverage, which they were entitled because the court didn't find any bad faith liability that they were entitled to deny. And so that's what makes Gray dispositive on the issue of treble damages. What's wrong with that argument?
First of all, Gray says there were no aggravating factors. It went to the jury, and the plaintiff's lawyer sent the interrogatories, never asks, are there any aggravating factors? And also, they didn't ask, is this a one continuous transaction with a breach of contract and the, you know, mailing the letter with the person who made a claim that the property, they had a lien on the property. So there's all these different actions, but nobody even talked about it. The interrogatories, but they did say, in the opinion, there was no egregious conduct found, so therefore they could not treble the breach of contract damages. They trebled, as a matter of law, as you do, the unfair and deceptive $117,000, but not the breach of contract because nobody asked. And so then after that, as you noted, there have been court of appeals, several court of appeals decisions. Fourth Circuit Bartholomew says the same thing, that you get treble damages. So there's three different ways, yeah. And the law right now is not clear which one, but you do get them. You get the continuous conduct. It's a continuous transaction. So what Philadelphia states, DNC has not come forward with evidence of any injury or damage that resulted from the alleged statutory violations separate from the damages that resulted from the alleged breach of the policy by Philadelphia's denial of coverage. Trying to separate it out. Okay, you have a breach of contract, $401,000 plus interest of $67,000. And then you have the unfair and deceptive trade practices that if they believe you, they go away and there's no lawsuit. If they don't believe you, they're going to say there's no reliance, there's no damages. So they just, the statute's a nullity according to them. So then you look at, okay, we have not come forward with any evidence. Well, it is one continuous transaction. And the continuous transaction has been recognized since Miller v. Miller, long time ago, 1980, one of the seminal cases, says you need a continuous transaction. You have breach of contract and you have unfair and deceptive and they are related, then you have a continuous transaction. You have Harlock versus Henson, same thing. Over a 3-year period, guy goes to a broker and says, sell my truck. Sells his truck, tells him, I didn't sell your truck, I didn't sell it. He sees it one day being driven by another person and says, I'm gonna sue you, I want my money for my truck. He gets to sue him, wins, and they give him the money for the truck and they give him unfair and deceptive trade practices. And what they do is treble the breach of contract. It's all one, you know, you can't separate it. So the damages, proximate cause damages, are all related. It's, I think somebody earlier used, you know, the circular method. You know, if they're overlapping, you have a continuous transaction. What could be more continuous than a denial letter that contains the unscrupulous behavior that their only hope was to make these people go away? And if it doesn't work, then you say, well, we don't have treble damages, nothing to lose. We know we have coverage or don't have. We know we have coverage, so why not take a shot at throwing this letter out there and maybe it'll go away? They're going to do it in the industry. Every single carrier.
Counsel, can I want to ask you a question about coverage before your time runs out. What is the relationship between additional coverage, point three, that additional coverage does not apply to a building that's standing? What is the relationship between that provision and the exception to the exclusion?
Exception to the exclusion creates coverage because it says it's an all-risk policy, and North Carolina recognizes when an accident has more than one cause, one of which is covered by an all risk.
Yeah, I understand that. I'm asking you, so the exception to the exclusion says collapse can be covered in certain situations.
Way to people.
Then the additional coverage section says collapse is also covered in these other certain situations, but it says this additional coverage does not apply to a building that's in danger of falling down or caving in, or a building that's still standing, et cetera. How does that provision talking about still standing or not having fallen down or caved in, but in danger of it, how does that relate to what it means to collapse under the exclusions and the exceptions to the exclusions, which are in a different, they're not under additional coverage collapse, but they're both talking about collapse. How do those relate?
We have additional collapse is any part of the building. Now this panel fell down. How many feet does it have to fall down to make it fall down under this policy? It doesn't say. So then they say, okay, is it? I guess that means that it hasn't fallen in or caved in. It's in danger. Danger means future. It already caved in. There is part of the breezeway that's on the ground. It caved in and it went to the ground.
So you're saying this definition of collapse, this expanded definition in part three that says it doesn't apply to things that are still standing, you think that applies to and defines what it means to collapse under the exclusions in section one?
I think it's as ambiguous as can be. I don't know what it means. All I know is it's not going to take away coverage when you have ambiguous. Whenever you can, in North Carolina's most favorable insurance coverage for the policyholder in the country, and it says if you can find coverage, you have to find coverage. If there's any doubt that there's an ambiguity, there's an ambiguity. This is ambiguous language. They have
to. Okay, thank you.
Okay, going back to the unfair and deceptive trade practices. So you have that.
Mr. McDougall, you're over your time, so I'm going to have to stop you. You're over your time. Mr. Brown, you have some time left for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to first begin on the question Judge Rushing was just raising. The endorsement, the collapse endorsement, has two components and they stand alone. The first part of it is the exclusion. So if you take the collapse exclusion and out of the endorsement and put it on the base policy, that would be applicable if we were trying to deny coverage based upon the collapse exclusion. We're not trying to deny coverage based upon the collapse exclusion. So therefore, that first portion, including the exceptions to the exclusions for weight of people, et cetera, is irrelevant. What is relevant is the next
section.
Yes.
I appreciate you trying to help me sort this out, but can I ask you to assume hypothetically against, I know you don't think that section one applies, but if I thought it did, if I thought that the exception to the exclusion there was, you know, provided coverage, how do I define collapse under that exception to the exclusion? Do I look to the additional coverage provision to help me define collapse, or
yes,
is that prohibited because it's a different section? I'm not sure.
No, the gateway to coverage here for the insured is without question under the collapse endorsement language before you. So the way, if there is coverage afforded here, it necessarily has to be afforded under the coverage grant for collapse. And so therefore, subsection three of that modifies everything having to do with collapse. So therefore, there is no collapse unless the building has fallen down or is in danger of falling down. A building that is standing, or any part of a building that is standing, even if it shows evidence of cracking, bulging, sagging, bending, leaning, settling, shrinkage, or expansion, is not collapsed. So very succinctly, that's where we hang our hat, that there's no coverage here. It's barred under the exclusions and policy that we discussed earlier that Judge Eagles identified. The only route to coverage is through the collapse endorsement, and the collapse endorsement, none of it can afford coverage if the building is still standing, even if it has cracking, bulging, sinking, expansion, et cetera, which is what we have here.
What about the fact that the building was condemned 2 days later and it's not occupiable?
And it was condemned because of the 14 years worth of water intrusion and wood rot that the engineers identified. That's why it was condemned, not because of anything that happened abruptly on that night.
Well, Mr. Brown, that's not accurate because it would not have been condemned but for what happened that night. There would have been no reason for them to know about it.
Well, it was known about, it became manifest that night. I agree with you. And whether it became manifest because of the crack or whether it became manifest because they happened to have a building inspector come by or became manifest because someone said, this seems to be a little, you know, a little bouncy as I walk across the breezeway, let's look at it. Whatever caused the damages to become manifest then led to the need for the repairs due to the long-term corrosion. I agree with you that the events of that night create a manifestation date, if you will, but that doesn't in and of itself create coverage. Let me speak to the letter, if I might. The letter, of course, is in Appendix 438. And the letter that's in question, and let's just big picture here, what we're talking about is, can the plaintiff not only find coverage, but treble the contract damages because there's something about this letter that is in violation of subsection N, failing to properly provide an explanation. The context here is Philadelphia investigates this claim promptly, gets an engineer out there promptly. Within a month or a month and a week, they've done quite a bit of work on this whole project. They go through all the engineering reports. They identify the policy provisions. They don't hide the fact that there's a collapse endorsement. They cite the PU ULT 142 on page J441. They don't hide that. There's nothing deceptive about it. And at the end of the policy language, they say, we respectfully must deny coverage because the damage is reportedly the result of long-term water intrusion and deteriorated wood framing. Then they go on to say at the bottom of that page, we trust your understanding of our coverage position is clear. However, should you disagree, please promptly communicate with us. So there's nothing, you know, there's been several suggestions here today that somehow Philadelphia was trying to get the insurer to go away and leave them alone and not come back, et cetera. And to the contrary, this is a very prompt claims investigation, an explanation that we're denying coverage for a very specific reason. Did it cite policy language perfectly? No. Was it written by, you know, legal counsel after, you know, much analysis? No. But this was a good faith attempt to explain to the insured what was going on. There was no willful violation. Attorney's fees and a violation of the statute should not have been found. And certainly the contract damages cannot be awarded based upon the letter. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Brown. Thank you both for your arguments. The case has been submitted. We would typically come down and greet counsel. We can't do that this afternoon, but we appreciate your...
I think according to the rules, because it's a cross appeal, to both of us appealed, I have a 5-minute rebuttal.
You're absolutely right. Go ahead, Mr. McDougal.
Thank you very much, Judge Diaz. So one thing is they did not cite the exclusion because they didn't cite the part that provided coverage here where water damage is mentioned, and I'm sorry, weight of people was mentioned. And so don't say that was cited because it's not there. And then additional coverage collapse, you only cited the exclusions that you referenced earlier, and the other 1.5 pages were left out. And then you numbered it wrong by number, you being your client. I'm sorry, David, not you, but number one, but I'm changing three so you know that something preceded it. So that was not cited in the policy and it was never discussed in the policy. And it's clear there's coverage under weight of people in section one. That's all you go to. It's not complicated. And going back to the unfair and deceptive, so you either have a continuous transaction, there's many cases that say if you have a continuous transaction and they with a breach contract and it's related to the breach of contract, then you have treble damages. There's also cases that say if you have aggravating circumstances, you get treble damages. Gray says there were no findings of aggravating circumstances, so there could be no treble damages in the breach contract. Some reason the plaintiff's lawyer asked the interrogatories the way he did, and they never found aggravating circumstances in breach of contract. They found aggravating circumstances in the $117,000 of probably the claim where they were sending the check to the, because they asked the first thing, what's a breach of contract? And then they were sending the check to somebody who had a lien. So that one says it does not have aggravating circumstances, so you couldn't have trouble damages in Gray. After Gray, the Court of Appeals on four occasions found aggravating circumstances and said, if you have aggravating circumstances and a breach of contract, you take them together. You don't separate them. And you don't have to say, okay, I want the proximate cause for this event. I want proximate cause for that. No, it's one event. What are the damages? It's simple. And, you know, I can go through what Judge Eagle said. She said there were damages. She actually said there were proximate cause of damages. On and on, he said, it's undisputed that Philadelphia did not pay anything on a valid insurance claim. So DNC has proven that Philadelphia approximately injured DNC. So three, you have to have the unfair and deceptive trade practice affecting commerce, proximate cause. She says right there, there's proximate cause harming DNC. And then finally, she says the same injury forming the basis of plaintiff's breach of contract claim is also sufficient for the purposes of an unfair and deceptive practice claim. So she's already ruled that we should be getting treble damages. And for some reason, she issued a order without any statement. It's just one page that says, I'm only going to award nominal damages. And there's no explanation. So also, so you have the continuous transaction, you have the aggravating circumstances, and you have the per se violation. And the per se violation has been interpreted to be the language, I believe, is unfair. So if you have a statutory violation, Rule 58, such conduct is inherently unfair, unscrupulous, immoral, or injurious to consumers. So question is, as a matter of law, per se violation, you don't have to show aggravating circumstances, because that language is the same as aggravating circumstances, and it's saying as a matter of law, it's immoral, unscrupulous, and you look at the regular packaging case, concealing a breach combined with acts to deter further investigation is enough to show aggravating circumstances. So you got aggravating circumstances, you have whether or not a per se violation, and a continued transaction. So if all these cases that show, basically it's simple. If you have a breach of contract and you have unfair and deceptive trade practices that relate to the breach of contract, then you get treble damages. Or else the statute would have no effect whatsoever. And the public policy is basically written in Marshall is you need to have a remedy. And that's why the legislature enacted the statute. And it's very clear.
Mr. McDougall, you're a little bit over your time. I'm going to let you say another sentence or two, then I'm going to have to stop you.
The purpose of the statute is supposed to be for remedial, for other reasons, private enforcement, and the fact that it provides a remedy for aggrieved parties. Well, if we take the offense, David Brown's argument, there would be no remedy. And the purpose of 75.1 is because, and this was written, Marshall v. Miller, Supreme Court, Unfair Deceptive Trade Practice Act was needed because common law remedies had provided often ineffective remedies. For example, proof of actual fraud involved heavy burden of proof, including a showing of intent to deceive. So that's why they enacted it. And the purpose of 75.11 by the legislature, and I'll end on this, to declare and to provide civil legal means to maintain ethical standards and dealings between persons engaged in business and between persons engaged in the consuming public within the state to to the end that good faith and fair dealings between the buyers and sellers at all levels of commerce be had in the state. Sounds pretty good to me. That's the purpose of the statute. And that's plaintiff's position is have to have a remedy. And you have a remedy throughout all these different laws.
All right, thank you, sir. All right, the case has now been submitted. And again, I thank counsel for their arguments. We typically come down from the bench and thank you personally. We can't do that, obviously, given the circumstances, but we nonetheless appreciate your arguments. And thank you, counsel.